Welcome to the court. We have two cases today. The first one is United States v. Spencer. Lieutenant Commander Wester, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, sir.
And Lieutenant Fisher, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well then, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court. May it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Commander Michael Wester, and I represent Lance Corporal Braxton Spencer. Chief Judge, may I have 3 minutes for rebuttal, please?
Granted.
In the final paragraph of the discussion, the lower court wrote that appellant's punishment was foreseeable under the plea agreement that he voluntarily entered into, and then said, as we have previously stated, we generally refrain from second-guessing a sentence that flows from a lawful pretrial agreement. Accordingly, we find appellant's sole assignment of error to be without merit. This is not the right standard. An appellant is entitled to a de novo independent review of the appropriateness of his sentence. So it was error for the court to suggest that it would refrain from doing so in this case. This court should presume that the court meant what it wrote and conclude that the lower court applied an erroneous standard, or at least there is an open question whether it had done so by virtue of the last paragraph of the opinion especially. And therefore, the proper remedy is to return the case to the CCA so that a proper review of the case can be conducted. This case has a strong resemblance to what occurred in United States versus Bear. There, like here, the court started out on the right foot, cited the law, gave a discussion of the facts, but then veered off course and made head-scratching statements, if you will, that could suggest that the court didn't understand the law, or at least didn't apply it properly. And that is exactly what occurred here. The lower court is not required to write an opinion, and appellant doesn't suggest as much. But when the court does write the opinion needs to comport with the law. The court, in other words, doesn't get half deference, doesn't get credit for showing most of its work. If the work that it provides reveals a misunderstanding of the law, then that's error and that requires reversal.
So if the CCA here were to issue this exact same opinion, but simply take out that one sentence, quoting partially Whittack, talking about refraining from second guessing, would, in your view, this opinion withstand appellate scrutiny?
I don't think so, Chief Judge Olson, because there's other parts of the opinion that also indicate a misunderstanding of the law. Your Honor points out a glaring part of the opinion, in appellant's view, that the court curiously omits the important part of the quotation of Whittack, which is the ballgame, other than to ensure that the sentence should be approved. That's the very duty that appellant raised or asked this court to apply here. But there's other problems, Your Honor. So earlier in the paragraph, the court telegraphs that sentence by saying that what happened was foreseeable. There's a plea agreement. He voluntarily entered into it. And in the previous paragraph, the military judge even, you know, didn't recommend suspending the BCD. It's instructive to this court that appellant and the convening authority agreed to give the judge discretion.
Now, why is that improper for CCA to consider that fact?
Standing alone, it's not, and that's similar to what this court said in Arroyo last term. It's relevant in the sense that it's part of the record and it provides some context, but it can't take the role of the court's independent duty. It can't supplant that. This court in Arroyo said that there still is an independent duty of the CCAs to review.
But the CCA was using words such as it is instructive. Why does that indicate that their independent judgment was being overborne as compared to simply indicating they're putting it in the broader context of what happened in the course of this case?
It could. So that's why the argument is not that if that sentence instructive, if that were the only problem in this opinion, we probably wouldn't have a problem. It's that we have that statement, then we have the follow-on statement of it sounds like deferring to the military judge's suspension recommendation, which is not That's inconsistent with an independent review. But then, and then we lead into the final paragraph where the court then explains how it's all foreseeable and that we generally refrain from second guessing. So it's, we ask this court to take those all into consideration when considering this case, because it's not just one gotcha that appellant is raising here. It's considering the court's opinion within its full and proper context. And this case is distinguishable from cases such as United States versus Flores. There, the CCA was silent on the issue and also had a paragraph in the, at the end of the opinion where it demonstrates that it did apply the law correctly. So we don't have that here. We don't have another indication that the lower court understood the law after making that problematic paragraph at the end. And nor does it save the court. Sort of get ahead of the argument here, nor does it save the court that it says in the conclusion, you know, we have considered everything in the record and the briefs and determined that it's correct. Well, if you operate with an incorrect view of the law, then you have lost that presumption that you applied the law correctly, and that's really the crux of appellant's argument here, Your Honor. The case of United States versus Thompson, if this court need not determine that the court below did not apply the law. It's enough that there's an open question on this point. And that's what United States versus Thompson stands for, that if the lower court writes something in a way that gives this court pause as to whether it applied the law correctly, that's enough to send the case back. In United States versus Bayer, this court said something similar, where it was impossible for this court to determine based on what the court wrote. Maybe they did apply the law correctly, but where it's impossible because of what they wrote, the proper recourse here is to return the case for further Article 66 review. In the government's brief, just briefly, the government suggests that this court look into what the court wrote other than what it actually wrote in order to sort of read into what the lower court's intent was, that they were merely responding to appellant's argument when they talked about how the military judge, how it was noteworthy that the military judge only spoke of suspension of the confinement but not the discharge. But that's not what they wrote. So you can't have it both ways. You can't say the lower court understood everything and look at this part of their opinion, but then take a part of their opinion that might be problematic and say, well, that's not really what they meant. To the contrary, this court should take what the lower court wrote as instructive as to what it actually intended in this case. So this court, again, need not write any opinion. This court's precedent is clear on that. This court need not write a treatise. It need not explain in perfect detail every thought that's ruminating through its head, but rather when it comes to what the court decides to opine on, at that point, it needs to comport with the law. And pending any questions, I'll reserve, if I could, the remainder of my time.
Man Wister, if just so I understand, if you take the presumption that the military judge and the appellate judges are presumed to know the law, and then you look at this opinion, is it your position that basically that one sentence is enough to rebut the presumption? Is that what you're saying? As opposed to what I thought Chief Judge Olson was getting at, or might have been getting at, I don't want to speak for him, but might have been getting at, is that if they're presumed to know the law, why can't they highlight something that they also focused on or might have focused on and write that in the opinion? I mean, you're suggesting that by simply highlighting this particular sentence, that might rebut the presumption that they are unaware of the law or have not followed the law. And that's what the presumption is, right? They're presumed to know the law unless something in the record indicates otherwise.
No, that's absolutely right, Judge Sparks. They are presumed to know the law. And again, it's not a gotcha here. To answer Your Honor's question directly, yes, our position would be, standing alone, even that statement creates enough of an open question as to whether the lower court applied the law correctly. But we don't even just have that one statement alone. It's the build-up to that statement. So in the United States versus Bayer, a similar statement arose where there was a suggestion that appellant got all that he was owed under the law. Or he, you know, and there was a suggestion, words to that effect. I'm misquoting it here, but the idea was that did the lower court merely defer to the consideration the appellant got at the trial level or with the convening authority? In other words, did he not get the consideration owed at the CCA level? And so where there's an open question, that's enough to then send the case back. And I think here the statement that you quoted, Judge Sparks, that would be enough, but we have more than that. We have the entire paragraph, and we have the buildup in the preceding paragraph on page 5 of the slip opinion, starting with, it is instructive to this court.
So, counsel, I think that, and I don't want to put words in Judge Sparks' mouth, but that with that sentence, it's there's two potential problems. One is that they truncated the sentence, omitting that initial phrase which specifically addresses sentence appropriateness. So that leaves an open question. I think that's your argument, that one, by truncating it and taking and deleting the sentence appropriate language, that calls into question whether they actually did it. And then is your other part of your argument in misunderstanding the law by virtue of the portion of the sentence they use that we will not reopen a pretrial agreement, that you're saying that they are deferring then to the convening authority and the consideration that the military judge granted the accused?
That's correct, Judge Johnson. Okay. Yes, there's really two parts to the argument. There's this, the final sentence alone where there's the omission, the curious omission of the important essential language here. But then there's also the preceding sentences in the case where, as Your Honor points out, the court appears to defer to what happened within the plea agreement. It's almost as if, without stating the case too far, that they're saying that he waived his right to a sentence appropriateness review by virtue of pleading guilty. That's not what they said, and I won't necessarily hold them to it, but that's certainly how it sounds. What are we doing here? He pled guilty. It was conceivable within his plea agreement, although it was different from the case last term, Arroyo, in that there was no mandatory punitive discharge. That was, in other words, up to the judge's discretion. But leaving that aside, the point being that the court took the approach that the plea agreement itself was something that appellant bargained for. And so while that's relevant for this court to take into account, it's not dispositive, as this court said last term in Arroyo. It is a relevant but not dispositive factor. The court still must do the independent de novo review, which appears not to have been done in this case.
Okay. And then by virtue of that, since this is a sentence appropriateness case, the standard of review is whether there's an obvious miscarriage of justice or an abuse of discretion. Your argument is that those errors are tantamount to the abuse of discretion. That is the abuse of discretion.
That is the abuse of discretion. They proceeded with an incorrect view of the law, and that's coming from United States versus Bayer, where the court has that open question where it's impossible to determine. Then the abuse of discretion occurs given that there's an appearance of proceeding on an incorrect view of the law, Your Honor. So that is indeed the abuse of discretion that occurred in this case.
Yeah, I have one. And, counsel, if we agree with you, the remedy is likely to just be new sentence appropriateness analysis, right? But that's what the appellant wants.
That's correct, Judge Hardy. The proper remedy is further Article 66 sentence appropriateness review. That's all appellant asks for at the CCA level, and that's all we would be asking for if this court were to reverse and remand the case. Any further questions, if I could reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal? Thank you.
Tom Fisher.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. My name is Lieutenant Stephanie Fisher, and along with Colonel Ian Pedden, I represent the United States. This court should find that the lower court did not abuse its discretion where it applied the correct legal framework and determined on the basis of the entire record that appellant's bad conduct discharge should be approved. The plea agreement was just one part of the whole that the court considered in affirming the BCD, and the final paragraph cannot be read separate and out of context from the rest of the court's opinion. In United States v. Winkleman, this court explained that in assessing sentences, a service court is not obligated to detail its analysis at all, but receives greater deference when it does so. It further held that a service court does not abuse its discretion when it applies the correct framework and considers the totality of the circumstances. Here, Your Honors, the court...
But it comes down to applying the correct law.
Yes, Your Honor.
So in terms of the rather odd truncation of the WDAC quote, and then saying, talking about refraining from second-guessing, isn't that what sentence appropriateness review, independent review, doesn't it really involve second-guessing?
Your Honor, we can see that the court did second-guess here. And to Your Honor's point that this court presumes that appellate judges know and apply the law correctly, so here they simply just did not quote the second part of the sentence that says, we generally, not we do not, but we will generally refrain from second-guessing a plea agreement unless it's under our Article 66 review. And so what this court's analysis...
Well, counsel, actually, see, that's the problem. The quote, and I'm sorry to correct you, but it says, the quote is, other than to ensure that the appellant's approved sentence is one that should be approved, and then they cite Article 66, we generally refrain. So the court, as Chief Judge says, they truncated the sentence by cutting out that entire first clause, which is, in fact, the operative language that's the sentence appropriateness responsibility.
Your Honor, this case is nearly identical to Flores, where there, this court was reviewing segmented sentences, and while the service court did not specifically state that we are reviewing each segment individually and then as a whole, when the analysis made clear that they did not misunderstand or misapply the law, there was no abuse of discretion. And what we have here is the lower court going through a full analysis. So in their analysis section, they start by discussing the severity of appellant's crimes. And it's telling that they've already explained what appellant did in the background, and then in the analysis they go into stating that there was these repetitive escalating thefts, there was serious misconduct. They called it a criminal enterprise. They noted how he stole items that were worth a significant amount on four separate occasions. They called it filching. They explained how he foiled the security. So what they're doing here is a review of the severity of his crimes, which is part of the entire record, and then they go into discussing the fact that it is instructive but not dispositive that the military judge had discretion to award the BCD and chose to do so. So these are all relevant factors that the court considered before discussing the plea agreement as another relevant factor, and that was simply the final factor that they discussed. And as this court has stated in Arroyo, they've long recognized that absent evidence to the contrary, a plea agreement is a reasonable indication of the fairness to the appellant of his sentence. And what the court transmitted here is, we have no circumstances that this was unreasonable. We just listed the relevant facts on the basis of the entire record, and nothing here suggests that this was an unreasonable sentence for the appellant.
Counsel, it seems to me that the word second guess could have two meanings. Second guess could mean, just as a descriptive matter, we rarely disagree that a sentence was inappropriate if it's part of a plea agreement. That wouldn't be so bad, because just as a descriptive matter, that's probably true. But it could also mean we rarely conduct an independent review. We rarely re-examine a sentence when there's been a plea agreement. And that would be contrary to Article 66. And given that, I mean, do you agree that that's the ambiguity? And if it is ambiguous, don't we have to send it back to get the CCA to just to clarify what they meant by that? Second guess is not a technical term. Don't we have to send it back to just have them tell us what they meant by that?
Your Honor, I don't believe you have to send it back, and I would agree with your first characterization, where second-guessing is just saying what this court again said in Arroyo, where it is a reasonable indication of its fairness, and where the court has detailed all of the relevant facts. So the court looked at not only the severity of appellant's crimes, but his character arguments. They considered the military judge's discretion. They looked at that recommendation for only the confinement to be set aside. And they considered appellant's clemency request, which did not ask for the BCD to be set aside. So in light of all those facts, the court is showing you that they are indeed second-guessing whether the plea agreement was the reasonable sentence, and they're not merely deferring to it. If their whole analysis was just, he got a plea agreement, he bargained for this, there would be no need to go through any of the rest of that in this case.
Do you agree that if it's an open question, what was meant by the CCA, that that alone means we should remand it?
Your Honor, I disagree that there is an open question here.
But do you agree with the legal principle that when there's an open question about the proper application of the law, this Court needs to remand it?
Under Bayer, this Court did say that if there is an open question, it should be remanded. But in the context of what the open question was, is the Bayer Court complied or applied a precedent that had been set aside that was definitively incorrect in the improper framework? What we have here is simply just half of a quote from a proper legal standard, and it's not an there's no ambiguity in the way that they applied that quote. So taking that last paragraph out of context is not appropriate under this Court's precedent in Flores or in Bayer, so there would not be a need to remand here.
Counsel, I understand what Baird said, but is Baird consistent with the idea that military judges are presumed to know the law? That, in other words, if there's an ambiguity, why don't we just resolve it based on the presumption that the judges knew what the law was? I mean, you've just said it's contrary to Baird, and it is contrary to Baird. That's just a question I have.
Your Honor, if I understand the question correctly, it's that should this Court in this instance presume that the judges knew and applied the law correctly?
If there's an ambiguity, the rule is we presume the judges know the law. Why doesn't that just resolve the ambiguity?
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe that should resolve the ambiguity here where there was no definitively incorrect statement of the law, and then the rest of the opinion points to the fact that they applied the correct legal framework. And so outside of that singular sentence, the Court spent a large chunk of time reviewing the entire legal framework that they use, so that they stated that they were going to review the sentence de novo. They explained that they may only approve the sentence that the Court finds correct in law and fact, and then determines on the basis of the entire record should be approved. They discuss that in exercising that function, they seek to ensure justice is done and the accused gets the punishment he deserves. They detailed how they acknowledge that he's required to receive individual consideration on not only his character, but the nature and seriousness of the crimes. And then they discuss that while they have significant discretion, they can't cross the line into clemency. And what the Court's entire analysis is showing is that each factor they considered militated in favor of finding that the BCD was the appropriate sentence. And so, therefore, ultimately setting it aside would be that impermissible clemency that NEARAD prohibits.
Counsel, in the government's view, what was the purpose of the CCA quoting that language from WEDAC? When they say, we generally refrain from second-guessing or comparing a sentence that flows from a lawful pretrial agreement, what relevance at all does that particular language have to what they're doing here in the opinion?
Your Honor, I believe the relevance is similar to this Court's precedent in Arroyo, and maybe that would have been the better quote, but I think it's just their recognition that a plea agreement is a reasonable, although not dispositive, indication that a sentence is fair to the appellant. So after they walked through all the other factors, they concluded by saying, we don't have evidence to the contrary that this was unreasonable. So while maybe a different quote would have been better, I think it's in line with this Court's precedent in Arroyo. So in sum, the Court did not abuse its discretion where it conducted a de novo review applying the correct Article 66 framework, and then, in determining that appellant's sentence appropriate, assignment of error was without merit, it considered the record beyond just the legality of the plea agreement. And one final point that I'd like to mention is appellant seems to state that because the Court did not conclude and therefore the sentence is inappropriate, that makes it an incorrect statement of law. But this Court has never required those rigid, formulaic, talismanic incantations. And what the Court concluded with is saying, we find that his assignment of error, the sole assignment of sentence appropriateness, is without merit. So you know they conducted the sentence appropriate analysis, and they're telling you that not only was this a close call, and here's all the factors we considered, but we considered everything on the basis of the entire record, and we find it to be without merit because there's nothing that weighed in favor of setting aside the BCD. So pending any further questions from the Court, the United States respectfully requests that this Court uphold the findings and sentence as adjudged.
Thank you, Lieutenant Fisher. Lieutenant Commander Wester.
In response to Judge Maggs's question, the reason the CCA should lose that presumption is that the statement comes right before the conclusion, which I presume is the holding of the court. So it's not just that this sentence appears, you know, somewhere sandwiched in the middle of the opinion, and after that the court does everything correctly. I said on earlier that it would be, you know, a gotcha-type argument. No, what we have here is a conclusory word, accordingly. So it's not that they just said the statement that we generally refrain from second-guessing. It's that they then say immediately after that, accordingly, we find appellant's assignment of error without merit. And that's important because in United States versus Thompson, there was a similar conclusory word that occurred in that case that I believe the court said applied a standard of requiring an appellant to provide some affirmative evidence, and then as such were the immediate proceeding words in that opinion. Similar in United States versus Bayer, we have as such right after the problematic statement. So context, it's not that we're taking it out of context. In fact, viewing it in the context in which the very court wrote the opinion, I think the fairest reading is that they made this statement. Statement is problematic on its face, not only because...
I think that's the issue, which is second guess is not a technical term. Second guess could have two different meanings. It could mean we don't give an independent review, which would be clearly wrong. Or it could mean, as a descriptive matter, when somebody gets a sentence that's within the range in the plea agreement, as a descriptive matter, we don't generally disagree with it. That is true. I mean, that's that. And so the question is, when we have that statement and we're trying to figure out if it's incorrect or not incorrect, why don't we give the where it could be either one? Why don't we give the benefit to the judges?
I think because, Your Honor, in the context, not just the statement, but especially that's the case. But I think here. I don't want to sound like I'm talking out of both sides. The statement alone, our position is enough because of what
if it's incorrect, it's enough. I agree with that. But if it's not incorrect, I mean, again, I don't think second guess has a technical meaning. I think they could mean two different things. One, we don't give it a review, or we don't generally disagree. And they don't just generally disagree, I think, is that's not problematic. I mean, that's descriptive.
I think, too, Your Honor, so it's the omission of the full quote. So that's the key here. They're not only just saying that, perhaps, assuming without conceding, that it was just a statement that appeared for the first time the CCA has ever uttered that sentence. Okay, perhaps that it could be looked at differently. But here they're actually quoting one of their prior decisions, and they're taking out the essential part of the quote. So, again, I think this Court should presume that in citing the case, the court or a law clerk perhaps reviewed the case, and for whatever reason, this court need not know the reason, omitted that first essential part of the statement. And so there, I think, Your Honor, a picture is painted. And then, again, earlier in the opinion, we have the other statements. And even the statement alone, though, staying on that statement alone, it flows from a lawful pretrial agreement. I mean, again, they're focusing on the fact that it was legal. I mean, that's not irrelevant, but when the only assignment of error raised was raising the appropriateness of the sentence, and the court seems to hearken back to the fact that the sentence was legal or the plea agreement was legal, a reasonable read, and certainly at least an open question on that, is that the court looked at the plea agreement as the dispositive factor. It's that the lawfulness of it was dispositive, and that contradicts the statute as well as this Court's precedence.
Well, I mean, I think that answer is really that you believe the statement's incorrect rather than it's ambiguous of whether it's incorrect or not. Let me ask a different question, though. This is one of the most thorough discussions of whether a sentence is appropriate that we see. The vast majority of cases where sentence appropriateness is addressed, it's addressed in a footnote saying, we've considered the sentence appropriateness and we determine the sentence to be appropriate, period. If we send this back, aren't we telling them, don't write anything, just give us a footnote? I mean, certainly the judges on this court are going to say, why did we go through how serious his crime was? Why did we go through what the military judge discussed? Why did we go through the terms of the plea agreement? Why didn't we just write a footnote saying, we've looked at the sentence and it's appropriate? It doesn't necessarily affect your client's got your own client's interest, but I'm just worried about what happens in a case like this where they picked words that were not appropriate, second guess, ambiguous, maybe wrong, and that the conclusion is don't do an analysis, just give us a footnote?
I understand Your Honor's question and concern. I think there, at a certain point, must be a deference to the professionalism of the judges of the CCAs, and we don't question that here. In fact, Congress, in United States versus Boone, said this court explained that Congress entrusted the sentence appropriateness review authority to the CCAs as a way of ensuring even-handedness or, you know, a measurement of sentences that may not always apply at the command level, given the military structure, even if the sentence at the command level was lawful. So the appellant is not asking these courts to order the lower court to write a treatise on this case, and the court has not given any indication that it will do a footnote review of the case. So I don't think this is necessary to belabor the point, but I understand the court's concern here. The court, by all appearances here, did an earnest job in sincerely responding to appellant's arguments, but the error in this case is that the court got off track at some point and proceeded with, in our view, an incorrect understanding of the law. And if they didn't, it's at least something that creates that open question that requires this court to return the case just to ensure. It's not the case that I do think that there's room for clarification. Just to summarize here, United States versus Kelly said that even when we have mandatory sentences, a sentence appropriateness review is still necessary. So it's an important function, and I would hope that the court would, of course, write more than just a footnote if the case is returned. But the case must be returned, and that's the crux of appellant's argument, Your Honor. Pending any further questions, appellant respectfully asks this court to return the case for further 66 review. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand in recess until 10:15.
All rise. The court stands in recess until 10:15.